was supposed to speak to the American Legion in Baltimore. And just before I went up to the microphone, a man came over to tell me, now there's going to be a slight problem during your presentation. We hope you don't mind. And I said, oh, just in it, nothing. Nothing bothers me, really. So I walked up to the microphone, and just as I started to speak, a band started up in the room next to me. And it was as if there was a paper wall. And I shouted over the band. The band stopped the very same time I stopped. Well, the American Legion felt so horrible about it. I mean, it bothered them more than it bothered me. They thought that to reward me, this was a smaller group of the Legion last year, to reward me, they would invite me this year to speak to 5,000 people out in Indiana at their convention. And so I went and spoke, and about 8 or 10 people came up to me and said, the band's going to play before you speak. I do have some formal remarks that I will use just to set the stage for what I hope will be a lively discussion, and some of the remarks I will use only to trigger some thoughts that I would like to share with you, because I do believe the experience will be more rewarding for all of us if it's based on give and take. Thomas Jefferson once said of public service that there is a debt of service due from every man to his country, proportioned to the bounties which nature and fortune have measured to him. So he was speaking of the debt of public service that we all owe, that public service is core to this country working. Now, unfortunately, we have gone through periods of time in history where the public has not really recognized the importance of public service and has not recognized the relationship between a quality public service and the government working, and the relationship between the government working and the country working. We did have a period during the Kennedy years where there was a feeling that public service was extremely important, and there was a relationship between the quality of people in government and the quality of service. The Eisenhower years weren't very bad, but then for the last 12 years, really, through the Carter and through the Reagan administrations, the bashing of the bureaucracy and the bashing of government was very much a part of the campaign slogan for the people running for office. And that represented really their attitudes while they were in office. Now, you will get people from the Carter years to argue with you that that wasn't the case, and you will get some from the Reagan years to argue that that was not the case. But by and large, there was not support from the top of the principle that public service was extremely important, and there was a direct relationship between the quality of public service and the nation working. I think that there is a renewal of interest in public service. We now have a president who has, for most of his career, been a public servant. and views public service as an honor. During the campaign, and I worked on his campaign, he charged us with putting out statements that talked about the importance of public service. We also had this last campaign, the Democratic candidate who talked about the importance of public service. In other words, we did not have a campaign where bureaucrat bashing was the theme on either side. And that helped. It helped that there were very positive statements made. But beyond that, once George Bush became president, he called for a renewal of interest in public service. He has charged his political appointees to honor those in the career civil service, has come out with a number of statements, has met with public servants, has sent out the signals that this is important to the country. But what is going on now, in my view, is something that has to go on, and that is we have to determine what is the role of government, what should be the proper role of the federal government. I think that although this is a very tough time for us now in having to deal with the budget deficit and the potential of having to furlough a million or more people in the beginning of next week, and all of the disruption brought about as a result of what may happen, I believe that there's something very healthy going on, because we have not really revisited for any time in the recent future what it is that the public expects of government. What is the relationship between government and the private sector, and what ought it to be? That what has gone on is there has been a reduction in resources, or at least a reduction in the rate of increase in resources available for government. But we have not in the past asked the tough questions about what of the programs that are now being run should we stop running. What we've done is we've cut just a little bit more each year. We've reduced the resources, maintained the mandate, and so what has happened is we're required to do the same things with fewer resources, so we're doing more things poorly. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. And because the cuts have been very small, we haven't gotten the public's attention, nor our own attention, about asking the very tough questions about which of these services, which of these programs, which of these policies should we now cut out, should we say ought to be the responsibility of other sectors of society. And the advantage of a 32% to 33% cut is that you can't just skim those cuts. You've got to go deep. You've got to go deep, and you've got to ask the tough questions. And I know that around Washington now, there are more and more people asking the tough questions. Should we really be having government involved in child care? Within the Office of Personnel Management, we're asking, should we maintain job information centers all around the country, or should we cut those down or out? To what extent should we continue to provide health care for our employees at the level that we do now? I'm not suggesting the answer. I'm suggesting that the pressure now is forcing the questions to be asked. And I think coming out of the budget problem that we have now, coming out of it, will be some redefinition about what the federal government ought to be involved in. We will be forced to do that. Also coming out of the crisis, I think, will be something that many of us have always felt should have taken place, and that is an agreement on a longer period of time of the level of resources available. A five-year agreement is a much more reasonable way to run a government, or at least a two-year agreement. But having to renegotiate each year what level of funding ought to be available for programs, and having sharp differences between years because the politics might have changed or the interest in certain areas might have changed, having to renegotiate that each year minimized our ability to plan and have planning mean anything, and our ability to start and implement programs so that they are effective. So coming out of this, if there is an agreement, even if it's a reduction, if we can know and if the public can know what the level of funding will probably be for the next 5 years, I think we have a greater opportunity to be more effective. Now, I make this comment in talking with employees and employee groups that out of this is something good, but I must say that those observations are not well received by people who are concerned about paying the rent and paying the groceries, and I understand that, but I do think that we can step back from this and say out of this chaos or the appearing chaos, I believe will be something that needs, that the nation needs, and that is a little more stability in the budget process and a redefinition of our priorities as far as what the federal government ought to be doing. At the same time that we're asking tough questions about what we ought to be doing today, we have an obligation to look at the future and look at the fact that the nature of work will change and the nature of the workforce will change, is changing. Two-thirds of the new entrants in the workforce between now and the year 2000 will be women. 17% of the new entrants in the workforce will be black. 29% will be Hispanics. We'll have the largest number of immigrants coming into the workforce since World War I. Now, people can say, this doesn't, so what? Well, there is an answer to so what. Because of the change in demographics, all employers are going to have to change their way of doing business. The fact that two-thirds of the new entrants in the workforce are going to be women means that employers are going to have to seriously look at child care programs. High percentage of the women coming in the workforce are single heads of household, or at least part of two wage earner families. And so although previously many people thought that being concerned about child care was not necessary and that it's just feminists pushing for it, those people cannot be heard now, because any employer who wants to get the best and the brightest of the new entrants in the workforce, going to have to recognize who's coming into the workforce, and if women are coming into workforce at high rates, they're going to have to look at child care programs, they're going to have to look at flex-a-place and flex-a-time and job sharing, part-time work, and the federal government is doing more and more of that. The fact that a very high percentage of the new entrants in the workforce will be minorities is important for this reason. We have to be honest about the fact that many minorities are coming out of school systems in inner city and other school systems that are not preparing them for the workforce of today, let alone the workforce of tomorrow. Now, in the past, many people would say, well, that's the problem of the school system or the problem of the larger society. And most employers have felt very comfortable in the past taking that position. But if you're going to get the job done, and if the federal government, if we're going to serve the public, we have to serve the public with quality people. And therefore, we cannot cross our fingers and hope that we're going to get quality people when we know that many of the school systems are not preparing quality people. That means that part of our resources have to be spent on preparing the future workforce. And I find now in going in and dealing with school superintendents and working out programs with school systems, we are way behind major corporations. American Express, Aetna, and IBM, AT&T, been working quietly with the high schools, with the colleges, and have gone back and even started with 7th and 8th graders. I mean, we're now working with Aetna on Saturday academies with 7th and 8th graders around the country, because most employers recognize that in order to have a workforce in the future to get the job done, they've got to start investing in the school systems. Now, this may be good for the school systems. It may be good that there are more people concerned about they're doing a quality job for whatever reason. And there is much more attention from the broader public about this quality of the curriculum, recognizing that we will not have people to do the work if we are not involved. I'll give you an example. In Washington, D.C., we give the clerical and secretarial tests, and part of that is a basic literacy test. 70% of the people from the graduates from the high schools in Washington, D.C. are not passing a basic literacy test. We can't get clerks. We can't get secretaries. And we can't get the job done without people who can do the support work. Yes, we have most professional people. We're starting to train professional people in using computers as word processors, and there's a great deal that is being done to provide the support needed, but you can't get the whole job done without having some support staff. And we are going into the school system and working with the superintendent of schools in 5 high schools to work to build a curriculum to provide job opportunities for the high school students. And we're creaming, we're taking the best of the high school students that we can get and preparing them to come into the jobs. I mean, we're having to do that in order to get the job done. And the only point I wanted to make is that the governments, and it's not just the federal government, but those concerned about serving the public and having a quality government have to look not just as at what we need to do today for our workforce of today. But we have to invest in tomorrow. And we are, yes, concerned about professional people. We're concerned about having policies that will attract people who graduate from colleges and have graduate degrees. We need people. Government is going to need people who are even more skilled in the future than today. But we also have to recognize that we've got to have a support system or the job won't get done. Let me just talk a moment about getting the professional people that we need. Because there has been so much bashing of the bureaucracy, and because we have gone through a period where public service has not been viewed as an honored profession, we have been going through a period of difficulty in recruiting college graduates and in recruiting graduate students and professional people. We have jobs in the National Institutes of Health and the Department of Energy. We have jobs at NASA that have gone unfilled for some period of time because people do not view public service as an honored profession. That's part of it. The other part of it is the fact that we don't pay. We are not comparable to the private sector. The fact that the public does not understand and appreciate what it is that government does makes it much more difficult when we go to Congress to get pay raises, Ralph Nader has been very successful in the past, and he's not alone. There have been others to argue that you do not need to pay additional amounts to public servants. So fine, that's a very honorable position for Ralph to take, and Ralph and I have had the opportunity to debate this issue on many occasions. That's fine for him to say that. But the result of that is we can't get the people we need to get the job done to make the government work so that the country works. So he can argue with me that why should people make more than the garbage collectors? I mean, that was one of the points. And I, you know, that's that we're not hiring garbage collectors to run the Department of Energy so that this, you know, I just said we're not even going to deal with that because that is, it's not relevant. But the fact that we are nowhere near comparability is making it very difficult. And yes, there are people who are interested in public service and are willing to serve the government, but people have to pay mortgages and rent. College graduates have to pay back student loans, and people want to send their kids to college just like everybody else. So although we have a good type of occupation to sell, and we do, there are very few occupations where people can make an impact on the lives of millions of people in their job. There are very few jobs where you can do that. In some foundations, you can do that to a certain extent. It is true that there are certain corporations that are involved in activities where you can make a major difference in the lives of people, but it's state, local, and federal governments where you can make policies and run programs that will make a major difference. And there are many people who are concerned and are interested in doing that kind of work. But if you don't pay them, they can't afford to take the jobs. And we are at now in a position where we can argue about how much we are behind in comparability. But we're not arguing that we are behind. We're behind either 14% or 30%, between 14 and 30%. Now, the government in the past had as the basic concept upon which it built its pay system, equity. And the pay system was built around the idea that people should receive the same amount of money for the same work, no matter where they worked. And that has been, that system has been in place for 40 years. Now, it sounds good, except it is not reasonable in this environment. And every major employer understands that you have to take into consideration the labor cost in a certain geographic area in deciding how much you pay. The federal government was dealing with this problem and using kind of a Band-Aid approach. Here and there, there would be special rates allowed over and above the base pay, and that was getting out of hand. And so now, there has been agreement, and we've even gotten the unions to pretty much, I won't say agree, but at least they're not organizing against us, to move the system away from the monolithic pay system to one where we base pay on the variations by locality. So there's a, the administration had a proposal. Senator Glenn had a proposal. His proposal has passed the Senate. It came out on the appropriation bill. Congressman Ford has a proposal on the House side. Well, it's Ackerman's proposal. Congressman Ford will take it to the floor. It's come out of the full committee. We're negotiating now on a few small items, the cost and presidential discretion, power and money. Once we get those straight, we will probably have a pay bill this session. Now, how does that help us address the issue of recruiting and retaining the best and the brightest in light of the budget problems and the fact that there's not a great deal of new money that will be on the table? We will be able to take the limited dollars we have and spend them as we need them. So if it doesn't, if we don't have to pay an engineer in Montgomery, Alabama, the same amount as we pay to get an engineer in New York, we will take the money and spend it on the engineer in New York. It's that simple. The unions and many of the employee organizations have a problem with this because in some communities in the past, the federal employees turned out to be among the highest paid in those communities, and so their status was above most of the other people in the community. And they now say, we are going to lose status. Well, from our point of view, we say, we're not running this government to give you status. What we're trying to do is to get the best people to get the job done. And if you're willing to stay there, if you're getting paid comparable to engineers in Montgomery, Alabama, then that's all we need to pay you. And on the other hand, we need more money to pay for people in New York. You see what we're moving to. We're moving to a system where we're going to pay based on labor costs in certain geographic areas. We will pay based on what we need to pay in order to recruit certain occupations. We are going to give management more flexibility to pay individuals to recruit and retain them as we need to. We're going to act like most employers. We're going to spend our money as we need to get the job done. This should help if at the same time we are able to improve the public's perception of government and improve the attitude of people looking for jobs about public service as an honored profession. Now, in attempting to improve the image of public service, it helps to have the president speaking good words. It helps to have the leadership in Congress recognizing and talking about the importance of public service. But we have a number of other levels that we have to operate on, and that makes it difficult. First level is we have to spend some time trying to re-educate the public about what government is all about. When I was coming along, we had civics in grade school and high school, and you did hear about the relationship between the Department of Agriculture and the food that you eat, or the Food and Drug Administration and the assurance that drugs and food are safe. But so many of the school systems have moved away from teaching civics and having people understand how this government works and why it works the way it is. And very few people really understand the checks and balances and relationships between the legislature and the executive branch. And that is a problem for the nation, that we are not teaching civics. And so people understand government in terms of their own personal relationships with an individual in government. And most people's personal relationships have to do with having to deal with the IRS or the Social Security Administration and the one individual that they had the opportunity or the unfortunate opportunity to speak with on the phone. And we can talk all we want to about the astronauts and the Nobel Prize winners, and we have many outstanding public servants, but the general public has developed its image of public service in the federal government based on their individual experiences, and that often has been unpleasant. Now, generally speaking, when somebody calls into a government agency, and I've said this on a number of occasions, they are not calling in to say, have a happy day. They are generally already ticked off at government. They have gotten some letter that they don't understand, or the IRS has said that they owe more, or et cetera. So they're already starting out mad. Now, what you need on the other end of the phone is, at the very least, someone who has a general idea about where it is they're working and what that agency does. And you need someone who generally has good human skills. Sometimes you need a psychologist, but we can ask to have all of our phones manned by psychologists, so at the very least we ought to have people who understand where it is they work, are able to answer the questions, and I have even suggested that we need to remove the hold buttons on the phone, because that is the other part of what goes on that is very irritating to the public. But our problem is a management problem, which gets to education and training. Our problem is, and I think many employers have this problem, they entrust into the hands of the people on the front line the whole image of the organization, and yet they invest nothing in the people on the front line. We don't recruit the very best for those jobs. We don't pay them. Managers don't make them a part of the team. We spend very small percentage of our money in training the people to do those jobs, providing them incentives, and then we don't fire the ones who don't do the job very well. And so I've spent a great deal of my time trying to go around to managers who often want to point to these people about how horrible they are and say, no, you're the one. You're the one who's horrible because you are not training the people. You're not making them a part of the team, having them understand what it is that goes on so that they can answer the question. And you're not removing those who can't get the job done. Got a lot of cowards who supervise and manage others. And this is not just in government. I thought we'd get all the answers from the private sector. We're looking at our performance management system and how do you appraise people. If you look at the way in which we appraise people in government, you would think everything was running just tip-top fashion because we don't have a bell-shaped curve. We have a steep incline, and almost everyone, 95% of our senior executives, are rated as outstanding. And so what I say, I go around and I say, go to OSHA. Now, if everybody here is as outstanding as everybody says they are, why are we still having increases in accidents in the workplace? I mean, I think there ought to be some relationship between how these folks are rated and what's their mission. You know, that ought to be linked up in some way. We're trying to get people to understand that there is an obligation in managing people to have honest discussions about what the goals and objectives are for the organization and then how the goals and objectives of a particular position are related to that and then how do you measure that. Communication back and forth through the rating period about how people are getting the job done. And then an honest evaluation at the end of the process. So I had the National Academy of Sciences, gave them a contract to come back and tell us how major corporations and the private sector run their pay-for-performance systems and their performance management systems, because I thought we'd get the answers, and then all we'd have to do was just, you know, write it up and send it out. Well, the interesting thing was we're about to get our report from the National Academy of Sciences. And I thought that we would have reports that major corporations would tell us that they've shown, there's been a showing of increased productivity when they move to pay-for-performance systems and they can see that productivity has increased by X amount. And what I found so far is yes, most major corporations have moved to pay for a performance system, and it's like a religion. They've done it based on belief. They just know it probably works, and they just think it's the way to go. But I have found very few, and the Academy found very few, that were able to say they have moved to this and they are continuing to operate pay-for-performance systems because they can show and they know that there is a change in the way in which people behave when you move to that kind of system. And I thought they would be able to give us answers on how to structure performance appraisal systems and the forms and all. And I have had heads of the human resource management of major corporations tell me that the way in which they run their performance appraisal system is the most effective way is to change it every 5 years, which I wasn't exactly looking for. I thought that they would be able to say, well, if you use three rating levels and if you use adjectives or if you use numbers or this is the way to do it. No, they say you got to. What you do is you change it because people get too comfortable with the system and then you start them all over again and then they get too comfortable and you start them. We paid $300,000. No, there's more coming out of the study, but I was just suggesting. We do need not only to change our pay systems, we need to work on the perception problem, the image problem. We must change the way in which we develop our present workforce as well as our future workforce. Government spends a great deal of money on training and developing the workforce. But what I have felt that we needed to do was to go back and analyze what core information do you need to work for the public? What core information do you need? What core skills do you need to supervise other people? And then what is the most cost-effective way to do that? And I won't go into the details of our how we're organizing to do all of that. I just want you to know that we recognize that in order to serve the public, we must change our way of developing the people who are doing the job. Now, one of the good things going on in government, and it's happened already in the private sector, is that top management, cabinet officers, now recognize that they personally have to be much more involved in the human resources issues. And for so long, these, how you deal with pay, how you deal with benefits, performance appraisals were assumed to be the problems to be dealt with by the personnel officers. Difficulty recruiting and retaining the people they need to design the requirements for the contractors and to get the job done that NASA needs to do. The FBI has had difficulty in getting its job done because it has difficulty recruiting and retaining quality people to serve as agents around the nation. So that the head of the FBI and the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Health and Human Services are now on a regular basis being involved in deciding human resource management issues. And this is a good thing. Heads of major corporations figured out that out a long time ago, that that's too serious a resource in the organization to relegate the resolution of those issues to quote-unquote technicians. Now, what's happening about the quote-unquote technicians, and we still have a great deal of work to do in this area, is making them a part of the management team. So often, the people in the personnel offices are reviewed only as technicians. You decide what you want, you go to them, you get them to fill out the papers, and then you get them to send out the checks. And you don't use them as part of the team to decide how do you get the job done. More and more, top management is deciding they need to bring those people to the table. Now, what we have to do in this business, though, is to be sure that the people who are brought to the table are qualified to sit at the table, that they know more than just how to fill out the forms, and they understand the requirements of the agency, and they understand the big picture, and are able to talk about the role of the human resources in getting the job done. Oh, why don't I just stop and we start talking.
Okay. Who'd like to
okay. Yeah.
In the whole time you're talking, I was thinking, wouldn't it be nice if we had a nice environment for these humans to grow up and live in so they can stay healthy and not be active. And the whole time I didn't hear anything but quality of the environment.
You're talking about the quality of the physical environment. It is very important that top management look at a series of issues in deciding how to recruit and retain the best. Series of issues having to do with compensation. So it means not just pay, wages, but it means benefits. It means health benefits. We're looking at now whether or not we ought to put into place flexible benefits so we allow people to take the government's contribution and allocate it to child care, to dependent care, to long-term care. That's easier said than done. It's easier said than done because every time we allow people choice, we move them away from the health benefits program, and the premium is built on the numbers in the program, and we may, as an employer, decide that our first priority is to see that everybody is healthy. Now, it also, we have a requirement to be sure that the total work environment is the proper environment, or we will not be able to recruit and retain. That means not just the physical environment. It means that we, as all employers are deciding, are figuring out, have to teach supervisors and managers that they have to involve employees in all of the decisions made about how the job gets done. They need to involve all employees. So the environment issue is a larger environment issue. It is, yes, the physical space ought to be good, but more importantly, we've got to change the culture and the way in which we all think about what our job is and who we're serving, and we need flatter organizations, and we need more participation on the part of employees in how to get the job done. That is, it's very difficult changing the culture of the organization. So many supervisors are threatened by involving employees in the decision making. So many supervisors feel, I had to report up to other people in my career, so why should I make it easier for these other folks and let them involve? I mean, there are all sorts of things that go on. If we're going to recruit people and get the job done, the people coming out of college now, the people who are coming out of graduate school now, are not going to be interested in working in organizations that do not allow them to participate in the decision making. So yes, we are concerned about the total environment, or we're not going to get the job done.
Next question, Bill Harberly.
Is there a mechanism within the federal service now that avails itself of the expertise of federal retirees?
Yeah.
There used to be at one time where you retained clearances and were called in from time to time. It doesn't seem to be working that much now. And the ones that I'm familiar with, they call you in to declassify documents or things like that,
yeah,
rather than an actual input policy, or maybe not that high, but certainly years of experience.
There is a greater interest now than ever before in our turning to retirees to get the job done. I mean, people change their policies based on their needs. And given the slow growth in the population and in the workforce, most employers, but the federal government in particular, is looking at ways to involve retirees more in the work. Now, the first thing we have to do, though, is we have to change the laws that prohibit retirees from retaining their pension at the same time making the additional amount for the job. I mean, if we have now, you know, there has in the past been the concern that people were double dipping. I mean, and that was the phrase that was used. In our new pay bill, We did put in a provision that the government would change its position on this, and that retirees from both the military and the civilian side may come into government and work without having to lose the benefit of their retirement. But the only way we were able to do that was to agree that the Office of Personnel Management would review the requests and approve them, because the unions are very much concerned about allowing this, because they are afraid that there would be a tendency then to use retirees, and that their members, and they're assuming that many of their, that they're not assuming that their members are retirees who will benefit from this, that their members will lose the opportunity to get certain jobs done. So once we remove that barrier, we're going to help agencies that are interested in using retirees much more. We'll remove that barrier. The Office of Personnel Management, for example, we have backlog. We conduct all the investigations of all federal employees except for the presidential. The FBI conducts them for the presidential. So we do thousands and thousands of investigations a year on federal employees. And we have a backlog. So one thing that I did was I said to the person heading that part of the organization that I wanted them to go and check the records that we had on former investigators or former FBI agents, and to use retirees to come in on a regular basis to help us work the backlog down. And it's not just in the Office of Personnel Management, but throughout government, I think you're going to see more and more use of retirees. But we first had to deal with the law on the books. There are not many people who are willing to come back in and work and lose. I mean, I know General Becton came in and headed FEMA, and he ended up taking home less than $15,000 a year because he could not keep his retirement and make the full amount of the salary. Not many people interested in doing that, so we had to take that off the books.
Other questions?
What do you do if somebody has let's say that they're a consultant?
Consultants, now you see, you have to be careful how you use consultants, because you really are not supposed to be using consultants in lieu of employees, and there are a lot of agencies that will use consulting contracts to get around that, but they can only use it for so long. And so, you know, you can only do so many consulting contracts. And when you start doing that, then you start raising concerns that people have that you're not competing those. And you're letting out contracts for personal services, and you haven't put bids out for other people to have an opportunity. So yes, agencies use that. What I'd rather do is see a clean system. You remove the prohibition, and then you just use people as you need to and pay them.
Well, I agree with you, but I think consultants are used a great deal.
But you see, but the reason you do it is you've got this other problem, and agencies are interested in retirees, and retirees aren't interested in coming in because they take such a bite. But if you remove that law, if you take care of and amend the law, then I can start cracking down on agencies, really cracking down on agencies that are using consulting contracts when they have this other vehicle.
Who is directing this for you in Congress?
Well, it's on both. It's on the House bill. I mean, we had it in our bill, and we saw to it that it got into the House bill. And it's on the bill that came out of the Senate. In the Senate side, No, wait a minute. On the Senate side, it's on the appropriation bill, the defense authorization bill, but it covers government across the board. It was introduced by Senator Glenn, but Senator Nunn put it on the defense authorizing bill. On the House side, Congressman Ackerman has it in his bill, and it's Congressman Ford's committee. But we're not getting the resistance that was there in the past. We're not getting the resistance. Now, when it first started, Defense Department came in for the prohibition to be limited just for the military side, and I said that we would not support that if we didn't also support it on the civilian side. And then so we got both of them in, and I'm not, you don't have to lobby that one. I think that one will make it.
You highlighted a very commendable desire for the government to get a high quality of employee. And with that in mind, how do you handle the difficulty of getting rid of a person for inefficiency?
Yeah.
I know that sometimes you can hang on forever.
Well, let me tell you, I spend a lot of time talking with senior managers in government, and they always want to say that it is the fault of the system that makes it difficult or impossible for them to get rid of people who are not performing well. Now, I know it's not the fault of the system. It's not basically the fault of the system, but I'm going to do this. I'm going to the administrative conference, and I'm going to have them go through all the steps that are now in place when you have to consider before you remove somebody. Have them go through all of that and tell us which ones we can remove and still ensure that there's due process. So that I don't want to hear, when we get through with this process, I'm not going to want to hear another soul tell me it's the system, because here's the real problem. The real problem is guts, lack thereof. It's that supervisors and managers are not honest in the rating process. So they rate somebody outstanding 3 years running, know full well people aren't doing the job that they ought to do, and then they come up and say, now I want to get rid of this person. So you look at the ratings and you say, it's a little difficult to get rid of somebody. I mean, unless they've killed the guy sitting at the desk next to them. It's a little difficult if you've got a series of outstanding ratings. So I'm saying your job is to be honest through the process. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, they really, if you want to get rid of somebody, you got to get rid of them. They don't just disappear. I mean, it's not magic. And a lot of people that talk tough are really cowards. So they say, I'd like to get rid of people. And getting rid of people is, first of all, you got to notify them, I am going to get rid of you. People don't like to have those conversations. And then, yes, you do have to have a reason. So they don't really want to have to document their reason. Well, you've got to do that. You can't just up and walk into somebody's office and say, I just don't want you here anymore. So that's a little work. You have to do that. And yes, you might have to go to a hearing. Now, what I do generally when I take over an organization is I frankly look for a couple of prospects, people who clearly ought to be gotten rid of. And then I get rid of one or two. I fire one or two people. It's amazing what that does for the organization. I mean, the word goes out, this person is crazy. And therefore, we need to kind of tighten up here, because this person is serious about firing people. Now, I'm talking about firing people who ought to be fired. So what I'm saying to you is, you will hear all around people say, it's a process, it's too complicated, you have to go through too many steps. That's not the real reason. It is people are not inclined to do it. Now, one of the other advantages, there are two things that are going on now that may bring about a change, the budget crunch. People still have the job that has to be done. They are not as inclined to keep dead wood around when they've got the same job to do and they have fewer resources. So people are getting a little tougher in how they deal with the poor performers when they have to carry them. That's a good thing. The other is that part of the administration's proposal was that we move to a pay-for-performance system. Now, the way I'm having to negotiate that with the unions, because they just went bonkers about that, we do have some pay-for-performance, but we were talking about everybody going on to that. What I did was negotiated that we would move to pay-for-performance, but we would have a labor management committee talk about the way in which we would move to pay-for-performance. But one of the outcomes of the National Academy of Sciences study is that some of the more effective pay-for-performance systems are ones where you pay based on team effort. And in fact, I've done a little of that around the Office of Personnel Management. So if you take X amount of dollars and you divide it evenly among all of the people in the team, and there's some people in the team not carrying the load, peer pressure takes care of some of that. Peer pressure takes care of information getting up to management that these people aren't carrying their load, and it puts a little more pressure on the system to get rid of some of the people who are not getting the job done. I mean, these are some of the things that are happening that may help in some way to remove some of the people not carrying the load.
Paul Drexler.
Yeah.
You talked about the difference between the government pay scale and private industry. You said there was a gap about 14% to 30%. Is this just the actual salaries, money, or does it take into consideration the whole picture, fringe benefits?
Yeah.
Things that you do not, once you work for the government,
yeah.
Or lose your job. The pensions are indexed when they are not in private industry, usually. Things of that sort.
It's the
how do you put money value on that?
Right. It is based on the wages only. Let me make a couple of observations. The federal government has probably the best pension system of any employer, or among the best pension systems of any employer. The problem that we have is that we've backloaded the benefits. And in talking to college graduates, and you tell them we've got a wonderful pension system, the eyes glaze over, that we can't sell this job based on our pension system. I'm just saying. Now, that doesn't mean that we're talking about changing the pension system, but I'm just saying, in trying to recruit college graduates and graduates coming out of with advanced degrees, we can't spend a whole lot of time talking about the pension program. The other thing, that the way the government is structured, and we're going to try to change this, we're way behind the private sector for the entry-level jobs. But by the time you get, say, 5-6 years up into a career, we're closer. But it's very hard to recruit college graduates to tell them, come on in. We know about those loans and everything. But by the time you're here 6 years, you're going to be pretty close to the people who went into the private sector. We can't sell. We got to sell. This is what we're offering you today. And this is what you'll get as you go along. Now, we have the best pension system, but we can't sell that too well. As far as our health benefit system, we pay 67%. Up until recently, most private sector employers were paying 100%. Now, most of them are moving back way away because of the escalating healthcare costs. Most of them are paying less, so we're going to be more competitive in terms of what we pay in health benefits. So that when I say the 14%, we did consider trying to combine all of that in trying to sell the package, because if we combine our pension system with the wages and talk more about the security, and we do talk about that, we have a better package, except that the truth of the matter is there are parts of that that won't sell, so we might as well just be straight up about what it is people are most concerned about and make the comparisons that way.
Howard Cromwell.
I wanted to ask you two things about getting rid of the institution. First, have you explored carefully in the 10-year period where they have to put in a certain amount of years before? The other thing is, what experience has been tried in transferring these people? Sometimes you get rid of them to
Timbuktu. Yeah. On the tenure, the probation period, what we need to do there is, again, train the supervisors and managers to really use that period. I mean, I know so often they slide past that period, the next thing you know, you're stuck. That is an outstanding opportunity to look at people and determine, you get a feel for who's going to have good work habits, who's concerned about really knowing about their jobs. You know a lot of that. Now, I'll tell you what happens in for the entry-level jobs. Because it is so hard to get people who are even breathing to come into a lot of those jobs, a lot of supervisors and managers close their eyes about the probationary period because they don't want to have to start all over with somebody else. Or they don't want to have long periods of time with no one sitting there to answer the phone, at least answer the phone or pick it up, so that they will blink and let the probationary period slide by. And we've got to do much more in insisting that they really use that, because that is an outstanding tool. With regard to transfer, I want to make another observation before I talk about that. That I basically believe, although this has been put to the test on many occasions on this belief, but I basically believe that most people can do something well. Now, as I say, that has been tested on a number of occasions, and that it is the job of the top of the managers and supervisors to identify when people have been slotted improperly and move them to positions that fit their skills and their interests and all of that. And that it oftentimes when you do that, you take somebody who's a poor performer and you tend to make them an outstanding performer, so that the determination that someone is a poor performer also ought to include an analysis of, is this person doing a good job? And so part of that whole process ought to be in the context of trying to find, is there some way to salvage this resource that we made an investment in? But once you've decided that you can't, the transfer to Timbuktu option is always a viable one, except I'll tell you what happens. They will go to Timbuktu, so you still got them. If you see, I've tried that one too many times. I've been around, and you will, you know, and then you're stuck. So I think what you got to do is you got to deal with it. You just, because I've just seen it happen too many times, and you know, sometimes they work out in Timbuktu, but generally they don't.
Wilson knew.
The number you've given us,
Bradstreet.
Yeah.
Wonderful catalog of your beliefs and practices, and obviously you're very much of an expert in your field. But in looking at from a governor's standpoint, I'm tremendously, and I think this group would be interested in what the facilities are for your bringing your beliefs and skills and experience into actual operation.
Good question.
And I would start with saying, to whom do you report? Who reports to you? And what authority do you have to implement your beliefs?
Okay. First of all, I report to the President of the United States. I run an agency of 6,000 people. We have 40 offices around the country. I report directly to the President. I am involved on a daily basis with the head of the Office of Management and Budget, with the Chief of Staff. I go to meetings with the President on a regular basis. I testify because I report to the President, but I report to the Congress, and I report to the press, and I report to the unions. and I testify, and spend a great deal of time in Congress, a great deal of time. I testify a great deal, but most of what gets done, as you know, it gets done with the cameras off. And so I spend, in order to get some of these things done, I first work it through the agency and the agency heads. In order to bring about this pay reform proposal that we're about to put on, it's about to come through. Let me just use that as a quick example. I set up a task force of representatives of the major agencies, academicians, the unions, the employee organizations, to talk about the problem with the pay system. Now, prior to that, we'd had Wyatt Company, and we'd had our own agency do a series of studies. Those were made public, and they were used as the source, the resource for this task force. Because what I wanted to do was get the task force to come out with a report to say the system is broken. Here are some of the ways in which we need to fix it. Then I used a representative group of the major agencies, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, the Health and Human Services, the power agencies. Now, I don't say that, you know, because the agencies that weren't represented don't want to hear this, but the agencies that have a great deal of clout on the Hill and within the administration to sit down with us and craft a proposal to change the pay system. I then worked with the Dick Darman and the Office of Management and Budget to get a proposal out of the administration. We needed a proposal, and I'm so happy we did that, because now I don't have to renegotiate a lot of those elements with Congress, because we've already resolved within the administration what our position is. Now, let me back up something, though, and to answer the power question, and I will take that example through. I think that it is extremely important in a position like mine to be political. Now, people can say all they want to about politicians, but the way I get to the President, the way I get to Governor Sununu, the way I get to Darman, is through political connections. I have known the president since the 70s. I worked in the on his campaign when he ran for vice president, and I worked full-time on this last campaign. And what that does is it allows you to get in directly to the people who are making the decisions and opening and closing the doors, because you spent 12 hours almost every day during the campaign with them. I can call Andy Card or Ed Rogers in a minute. Now, that doesn't sound important, except it is important. What is also important is people know I can call the president. Now, I don't call the president on a regular basis. There are only so many dimes I have. But the very fact that people know I can call the president, and I don't even threaten very often. I try to save the times that I threaten to call the president. But just that gives me, I've got so many dimes to spend on that. And so what I think is that in order to get ideas into place, yes, you need a process. You need to know that you have to involve the unions and the agencies and get people sitting down to talk about the problems. You need good research. The only way I can get these things done is that there are quality people doing quality work in the Office of Personnel Management. It would not do for me to be dashing out there talking about reforming the health care system or the pay system if I didn't have people who had the analytical ability to put together the proposals. I can call in and I can say, I need to know what the employment cost index minus 0.5 is for the next 10 years, and I need it in 15 minutes. Because I can't negotiate if I don't have access to information like that in a turnaround time, and I have that in the Office of Personnel Management. So that my point, though, is that you can have quality people. You can be competent yourself. But if you can't get your phone calls returned, and if your threats don't mean anything when you say you're going to go to the top, you're not going to get but so far. The other thing that I learned early in my career is to spend a great deal of time with the staffs of congressional members on the Hill. Now, frankly, a lot of people at my level think that they only ought to be dealing with the members. I am up on that Hill, wandering the halls, talking to staff members on a regular basis. And people had all kinds of bets out that we would not get pay reform through this legislation, this session. And I think part of the reason that we are is there are some outstanding staff people on the Hill. And we have spent a great deal of time together figuring out what that legislation ought to look like, where we had to negotiate, who would negotiate out which parts of it. And so all of the speeches I make don't matter if I can't get anybody up on the Hill to pay attention, and if I can't, and we don't have a good working relationship. So on the pay reform proposal, after getting it, the administration's proposal out on the Hill, then the power and the politics shifted to the Congress continuing negotiations with the unions and the employee organization. And now I have to go back to the White House and to the Office of Management and Budget to take back proposals that we had not agreed to see how much of that I can get accepted on that side. No, I don't talk to the president every day. And I do limit the number of issues that I escalate. Dick Darman and I, and this is a very helpful thing, worked together. We worked for Elliot Richardson at Health and Human Services. And it helps that we know each other. And it helps that the folks that I have to deal with in the Office of Management and Budget know that if they really give me a hard time, you know, I'm just going to call Darman. So My power comes from the competence of the people in the organization. And it comes from, I've been around a long time, I mean, that helps in knowing a whole lot of people. But it also comes from politics. And I watch the people who have trouble in these political jobs. And the ones who have the most difficulty are the people who view politics as dirty business and are not willing to deal with the politicians, because you do not get things done in Washington without dealing with politicians, because they're everywhere.
Got a lot of questions and not much time. Those who haven't asked any question, Arthur Stocker.
So far as the level of compensation is concerned, public and private sector, doesn't the civil service system place an almost insoluble barrier in the way of achieving that? In the private sector, a man is paid on the basis of his profitability. And if his work is resulting in increased profits for the company, he gets high compensation. When it ceases to do that, his job is abolished. His compensation is not frozen at that level for life. In government, when you're a GS this or that, unless you are provably incompetent, you're frozen at that level for the rest of your life. And so would it be really feasible to pay the top people at the same level as the top people in the private sector?
Mm-hmm. Let me say a couple things about that. First of all, Darman and I are trying to get the government to realize that they do have a bottom line. Government agencies have a bottom line. If it's OSHA, it's reducing the hazards in the workplace. And they can't get away with saying we don't have control of everything that goes on, therefore you cannot measure our bottom line. You can quantify a great deal of what government does. Now, in the policy-making areas, it's a little more difficult. But I say we take all those areas that we can quantify and identify them and quantify each individual's responsibility based on the bottom line of the organization. One of the reasons why I insisted that we put pay for performance into the legislation is that we do want to pay people based on their contribution to the work that has to be done by the organization. And so when we start moving to the system that I'm talking about putting into place, people will not have an entitlement to increases each year. Their increases will be based on the contribution that they make to the organization meeting its goals and objectives that are quantifiable. And one of the, one of the objections that the unions and some of the employee organizations had to our proposal was that we are moving away from automatic annual increases. And it is going to be based on performance. Now, what we've had to do, there are two things that we're having to do just to deal with the politics of it, since the unions objected to too much, is that we're splitting. We will probably split annual increases so that we'll take the pool of annual increases and say that everybody who is fully successful. Now, we're not talking about giving annual increases to anybody who's a poor performer. But we're talking about taking a certain percentage that is the annual increase, the pool of annual increase, and give it to everybody who is fully successful or above. And then the balance, and we have to debate about what that split ought to be, the balance will go solely to people based on outstanding performance related to their improving the bottom line of the organization, improving the productivity of the organization. That's a whole new way of thinking about how government pays its people, but that's the direction in which we're moving.
Very brief questions from two of you who raised your hands. Bill Harmon.
How effective has the Inspector General's system been in government? Is it helpful?
Well, I have mixed feelings about, I have a lot of feelings about the Inspector General system. First of all, it's absolutely imperative that you have an Inspector General system. But it's imperative that you have an Inspector General system where you have Inspector Generals who understand what their job is and then they actually do it well. You cannot have cowards in those jobs. They have responsibilities for identifying what is going wrong and notifying Congress when the executive branch does not pay attention to their warnings. Now, the reason I'm raising that is that, I'll just say it anyway. I mean, I raised some questions about how did HUD get as bad as it got? How did the savings and loan scandal get as bad as it got? If there were effective, very effective people asking a lot of questions. There's too much going on there that somebody should have seen over a long period of time. Now, the Inspector General at HUD now, you know, he was the one that finally came out and identified some of these problems. But he's the same guy who was sitting there all along. Now, what I think happened was, and I've looked at some of the reports, was that he looked at, I really don't want all this published because I got to live with these guys.
You can edit.
But you look at some of his letters and all, and he would signal there might be a slight problem over in this area. And then he later pointed to his, I told you so. Well, there's a way that you talk about a problem and you raise the level of consciousness about it. And you see there's a funny way in which they're structured. The Inspector Generals report to the head of the agencies. So they still, or many of them are kind of skittish about how they deal with the heads of agencies. Now, they are statutory now. The Inspector General of the Office of Personnel Management is statutory. I leave them alone. I mean, I have suggested to the Inspector General some areas that I would look at if I were they. And maybe they're suspicious that I'm suggesting those, that I'm trying to keep them away from other areas. But the truth of the matter is it's in my interest to know what the problems are. I don't want to, after I leave OPM, open up the paper 5 years from now and have people talk about this big mess that was there in the health benefits program or the pension program that I didn't know about and the Inspector General didn't notify me about. So part of what I think about the system is you really need people with guts in it and they need to do their job. The other part of it is I have a slight irritation with the way they've expanded the role of the Inspector General in two ways. One, they've got power to evaluate the effectiveness of programs. See, I think that's diffusing that resource. We've got all kinds of people evaluating effectiveness. And then you got these folks second guessing your policies and how you're carrying out your policies. So you already have to go out and testify on the Hill every week about your policies and how you're implementing them. And then you got this other set of people coming in and asking, well, why did you decide to give the test to include the achievement of individuals? You know, and I just want to say to them, that is none of your business. But then you tick them off, then they go and start down some, you know, so it's a very good question. But I think there was a mistake in broadening their authority to evaluate the effectiveness of programs. And now we've got them as we've got some of them as investigators. Now some of them are going to be toting guns. I think that's a mistake, because they will, and the reason they're going to be toting guns is in order to come under the retirement system of law enforcement people, they've got to have the same authority as law enforcement people. Now, see, that worries me a little bit, having these guys upstairs. There's nothing going on in our building. I mean, we're examining people and processing checks, and they're going to be sitting around. I don't know that they'll have guns, but they'll have the authority. And so I kind of worry about what Congress is thinking about. You know, I would rather have them have uniforms on if they're going to have guns. You know what I mean?
In the 70s, I recall, I traveled with Secretary Butts, and they had the thing. We got into Venezuela, and they stationed themselves at four corners of the room when we...
The Inspector General?
Right.
Yeah, see, I think we're confused about what they ought to be doing. I think if you need security guards, you ought to have security guards. They ought to be called at. Everybody ought to know them. They ought to have a hat or something so you know who they are.
Tom, will you ask your question privately? I think we're gone beyond our time. When we asked at the Kennedy School, where our guest spent 3 years, I think, or the Woodrow Wilson Center and other places, we didn't need to ask this, having heard her, why they said she's extremely intelligent, she's very experienced, and then they added an adjective that isn't usually used of intellectuals. They said she's tough. And we've had a good illustration of that in some of the comments, but a great many other things as well. We thank you very much.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Also to listen to someone from Bates. My first teaching position was at Bates.